Alrighty, we're on day two of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Come on up.
Come on up.
For the record, I am Representative Greg Smith, Chair of the Committee. We have Robin Lamont, our good LFO staff person who keeps us on task, and we have Kathleen Bell, our committee assistant, who graciously takes good meeting minutes for us. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
And again, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. To my right is Floyd Lanter, who is Administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. We are going to be, depending on your time frames, of course, moving some people back and forth so that we can cover a number of our different divisions. We're going to start with Floyd. Before we get started, I wanted to mention just a couple of things. We have provided you with a letter responding to some of the questions that were raised yesterday. It should be in front of you. I'm not planning to go through it unless there are questions, but I wanted to mention one thing. You asked for copies of a number of surveys that we've done in Oregon OSHA and in the workers' compensation area, and there are quite a number of those. And so in an effort to perhaps save paper, what we have done is provided the chair and Ms. Lamont with a notebook containing the full sets of survey responses. We are happy to provide additional notebooks to any members who would like them, but we thought we would actually ask that question before going crazy in the amount of paper that we produce.
Well, I think that's wonderful. Why don't we just pass it around, and if individual members would like more information, they can get a hold of you at a later time.
Great, and I believe you will find some indexes in there so that you can work your way through the individual surveys. I would point out also that we actually spend a fair amount of effort on customer surveys. That is one of our performance measures, customer satisfaction. So if you have questions about the divisions that you're going to be hearing from today, I'm sure they will be able to address them. And, of course, if you would like copies of any of the surveys we do in our other areas as well, we're happy to provide those. Again, we could do another notebook or provide them individually.
That's perfect. Corey, the one thing I'm going to remind the committee very quickly is we have, 2 hours and 25 minutes. We have a very, very long schedule in front of us. And so I'm going to ask members to hold their questions unless it's very pressing. And perhaps we can address those at the end. And then I'm going to ask you, Corey, if you could help us kind of schedule our time and make sure we get through everyone, because I want to make sure that Greg has a chance to wrap up, it looks like, at the end.
And then on Monday, we are planning to come back with performance measures and prioritization.
Perfect.
And I guess I should just say one more thing before I let Floyd get started, which is coming right after Floyd is Joel Ario, the administrator of our insurance division, and he will probably not mention this, but I will just in advance extend his apologies if he falls asleep in the middle of his presentation because his baby was born Tuesday morning.
Oh, congratulations.
So, Floyd?
Thank you. Chair Smith, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter, and I serve as the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Thank you for allowing me to be here this afternoon to provide an overview for the division. I'll talk about our mission, our program structure and delivery, strategic initiatives, funding, and significant accomplishments in an effort to assist the committee with its challenge of establishing priorities. As a preface, it's widely recognized that access to capital and financial services is a passport to our modern economy and key to economic growth. Access to capital helps drive business formation and fuel economic growth, make housing affordable, and let consumers purchase goods conveniently. The division is a key guardian for that access in Oregon, and our financial services and securities program responsibilities and activities touch the lives of most Oregonians. Our mission is to encourage a wide range of financial services, products, and information for Oregonians delivered in a safe, sound, equitable, and fraud-free manner. To that end, we administer and enforce laws and rules through licensing, registration, examination, and consumer or investor information functions for some 15 different programs. In discharging these responsibilities, we work to command the confidence of Oregonians, including the legislature, that the businesses regulated by our programs will be operated honestly, fairly, and efficiently, as well as to protect the right of Oregonians to participate in a financial services environment that's safe, sound, and protects against fraud and abuse. Our activities are linked to the governor's principles of public safety and economic development. Our programs in the division are split into two sections, finance and securities. Finance is further split into what we call depository financial institutions and non-depository institutions. With respect to depository financial institutions, these are our banks, trusts, savings and loan associations, and credit unions. The common thread for these programs or institutions is federal deposit insurance. All of them operate with the benefit of what's known as the federal safety net. Our program activities in this area are governed in part by formal working agreements with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the National Credit Union Administration, and the Federal Reserve Board. These agreements serve to reduce regulatory burden, promote supervision efficiencies, and minimize costs. Our primary focus is on the safety and soundness of these insured institutions and maintaining public confidence in the safety of their assets. These programs foster a stable financial services environment enjoyed by nearly all Oregonians and many small businesses by ensuring access to capital, credit, and other financial services. The state chartered institutions regulated by these programs are largely community-based with strong local identities. At year-end 2004, 97% of our 67 total federally insured institutions operating with collective assets of about $33 billion were regarded as satisfactory or better in overall condition based on their latest examination findings. Now, our non-depository financial institutions, or providers of credit and other financial services, include 11 different programs. In fact, we license over 3,000 different firms here in Oregon. These include mortgage bankers and brokers, consumer finance companies, collection agencies, credit service organizations, debt consolidation agencies, international trade consultants, money transmitters, pawnbrokers, sellers of travel, certificate authorities, and prearranged funeral plans and endowment care cemeteries. Quite a list. Three of these industries provide access to credit, and those include the mortgage bankers and brokers who facilitate home ownership or refinancing. This program licenses about 1,500 mortgage brokers or bankers, which operate nearly 3,000 offices and employ almost 12,000 loan originators in Oregon during 2004. Consumer finance companies also grant credit. We have 574 licensees currently. These include our payday and title loan lenders who make small, high-cost personal or consumer loans. And as you know, the payday and title loan lending industries have somewhat of an image problem that stems from too many anecdotes about high fees, poor disclosure, and aggressive collection efforts. I think an alternative characterization of these industries is that they provide much-needed credit for lower- or middle-class workers experiencing some financial crisis or challenge. And the last program in this area that grants credit is pawnbrokers. We license 45 pawnbrokers who specialize in advancing funds on collateral assets. The balance of these programs provide a variety of financial services ranging from credit repair to prearranged funeral plans. And actually, the division has proposed the elimination of two voluntary registration programs in this area, our Certificate Authorities Program and International Trade Consultants, due to a lack of industry interest. We have one entity licensed in each of those areas. The division strives to maintain or command the confidence of Oregonians, including the legislature, through our licensing, registration, examination, and enforcement functions for these programs. Our success in these areas is partly reflected by the volume of consumer complaints that we do receive and process. In 2004, the division processed a total of 672 complaints across the entire division. It's actually down 3% from the previous year. And the non-deposit programs, excluding mortgage lending, accounted for 110 of these, or 16%. So we get very few complaints in this area, with the exception of mortgage lending. Mortgage lending, we received 184 complaints last year. That's about 27% of our total. In the securities area, our program is responsible for the registration, licensing, and enforcement. This program fosters business development by promoting capital formation and protecting investors by registering, overseeing, and examining securities offerings, investment advisors, and securities brokers, and by investigating violations and prosecuting securities fraud. The program oversaw the licensing activity for just over 3,000 firms last year and 110,000 salespersons conducting securities activities in Oregon. It also provided for the processing of 5,400 securities offerings with a face value of $1.6 trillion. The division has two financial education initiatives. We have a investor information program, which is within our security section, and we have a consumer information specialist that functions within the mortgage lending program. Both focus on educating investors and consumers to help them identify and avoid fraudulent investment schemes and predatory mortgage lending practices. Collectively, these programs have developed some 79 consumer information publications addressing investment issues or predatory mortgage lending practices, including 8 in Spanish. The two representatives of these financial education initiatives participated in 194 outreach functions last year across the state, with some 13,700 Oregonians participating in those functions. The basic description and purpose of these programs, as well as an organizational chart, including staff, can be found under the Finance and Corporate Securities tab in your executive summary notebook on page 1. And I would be happy to discuss specific program activities as the committee desires. In addition to using the department's identified strategies and the governor's principles and priorities as guides in pursuing our mission, we also strive to ensure that providers make financial products and services available in a straightforward manner, disclosing sufficient characteristics so that consumers can make informed decisions. We also strive to provide professional, consistent, and objective program oversight while valuing excellent customer service. We also strive to maintain open lines of communication and be regarded as a resource for consumers and stakeholders, including legislators and licensees. And lastly, we contribute to the progress of 5 department performance measure targets to ensure that the objectives of public policy are being met, thereby helping contribute to the department's 3 high-level goal outcomes, as well as to the objective of Oregon Benchmark Number 9, which is Oregon's national rank and the cost of doing business. We receive no general fund revenue. We're financed exclusively by assessments and fees from regulated industries. And some of the more notable outcomes or performance accomplishments over the last year include in the bank area. We chartered 4 new banks last year, 2 in Eugene, 1 in West Lynn, and 1 in Lake Oswego. In fact, at 6:30, Oregon had the 4th highest percentage of new banks in the nation, and a new bank by definition is any bank that's been open for 3 years or less. And that suggests investor confidence in the industry and the state's economic outlook. Of our state's, of the state's 35 chartered banks, 16, or 46%, have been chartered over the last 10 years. And despite that youthfulness, state bank performance has exceeded national results over that period of time. Lastly, I would add that the bank and trust program has been accredited since 1992 by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, the Nationwide Trade Association. In the credit union area, we have 2 federally chartered credit unions based in Coquille, Oregon, and Grants Pass convert to state charters in 2004, and we processed several mergers in the industry. Nearly 70% of our state chartered credit unions have been operating successfully for more than 50 years. overall performance of this industry has also been strong and has met or exceeded national results for several years. In fact, the last state-chartered insured institution, which happened to be a bank, that failed in Oregon was in 1987. In the consumer finance area, we, in collaboration with our sister states and the Oregon Attorney General's Office, we finalized the consumer restitution segment of a nationwide settlement with Household International that provided $484 million for the settling states. Some 8,000 Oregon-based customers of Household received a total of $8 million, or an average of $954 as a result of that settlement. The division also conducted a program or a policy review of payday lending in Oregon during 2004 that involved a number of consumer advocates and stakeholders. The review's findings provide information on the activity and the breadth of the industry in Oregon that may be beneficial to legislators and other policymakers. The division also finalized several cease and desist orders in this area, assessing civil penalties of $31,000 and requiring restitution totaling $267,000 for consumers on violations of the Consumer Finance Act. In our pre-needs area, we obtained an order revoking the certification of a Eugene-based provider of pre-needs funeral contracts. The order resulted from violations relating to mishandling pre-need funeral trust funds, use of illegal pre-need contracts, and failure to comply with state reporting requirements. And I would add that the 2001 session actually transferred the authority for this area from the Secretary of State to the Department as a result of some similar fraudulent conditions in the industry, actually in Southern Oregon. So we feel we've been up to the challenge of administering that new program. In the mortgage lending area, we participated in a multi-jurisdiction task force that addressed predatory lending practices targeting the Hispanic community in Yamhill County. These activities resulted in 8 indictments. 16 formal enforcement actions assessing civil penalties of over $200,000 were initiated in 2004 to address violations of Oregon's mortgage lending law as well. In the securities area, we continue to participate with other states and federal regulators in what's known as the Wall Street Global Research and Analyst Settlement. Our participation thus far has resulted in almost $5 million being transferred to the general fund in penalties. Another $385,000 will be transferred once 2 additional settlements are finalized. Locally, the division processed 103 securities-related citizen complaints, opened 47 investigations, and finalized 35 cease and desist orders, and levied just over $1 million in fines, penalties, and restitution with respect to those matters. You can find additional performance accomplishments on pages 3 and 4 of our supporting material. I hope this provides you with sufficient information to capture the breadth and depth of the programs. Division's program activities and how we interact with Oregonians. And I appreciate your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have of me.
Any questions of the committee? I have one question. Can you share with me, is there any regulation of our 501c3 or 501c4 nonprofit development corporations that are involved in lending activities?
Chair Smith, I would have to research that to get back to you. Most the only nonprofits that the division regulates are credit unions, for the most part, and you know they file IRS forms on an annual basis and such. But 501(c)(3) and what was?
Well, the answer must be no.
Well, I'd be glad to research it for you. I mean,
I'd just be interested in knowing who is doing the oversight on our community development corporations that have millions and millions of dollars at their disposal for gap financing, tools that are used in partnership with credit unions and banks.
Chair Smith, I believe that the Department of Justice has a charitable activities section or operation that covers that.
But we will get back to you on that.
I'm just curious. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Floyd. And next, we'd like to ask Joel Aereo from the Insurance Division to come forward.
Mr. Chair, while Mr. Aereo is coming forward, I had a couple of things I wanted to point out to the committee. One is that I have distributed next week's agenda, and I am being an optimist and assuming that perhaps we will get through this department before the full day on Tuesday, so I have noted a possibility that the Department of Housing and Community Services may start earlier than anticipated. Likewise, if they proceed as quickly as we appear to be doing here, there's a possibility that the Department of Transportation could start on Friday.
Very optimistic.
The other thing I wanted to request was if members would please leave their DCBS overview notebook here today. The department will add some tabs in the appendix area that'll make it easier for the committee to go through the performance measures and the priority list.
I'd also like to say welcome back to Senator Johnson.
Thank you.
It is good seeing you a little healthier.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Aereo. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. A couple preparatory remarks. First, I'll do my best to help Robin achieve her goal of getting us out of here more quickly. And secondly, I understand you were up to your eyeballs yesterday in the workers' comp system. We have some responsibilities in insurance for workers' comp, but we also regulate all the other lines of insurance and, frankly, spend most of our time with those other lines of insurance, which include the basic consumer products of life insurance, health insurance, auto and homeowner insurance, as well as a number of commercial insurance products. We certainly work closely with the workers' comp divisions and OSHA and so forth on the workers' comp unit issues, but most of what I'm going to talk about is outside of what you talked about yesterday. With that brief set of preparatory comments, the three things that I'd like to talk to you about for 10 or 15 minutes here are, first, the Insurance Division's mission, an overview of what we try to accomplish in the Insurance Division. Secondly, the three specific purposes that flow out of that mission. And then third, a little bit on the three program areas that we have to accomplish our mission and purposes. Most of that will be left for phase two, but I'll hit on some of the key points there today as well. In terms of mission, if you look at page two of our materials, you'll see that our mission is to administer the insurance code for the benefit of the insurance-buying public while supporting a positive business climate. The emphasis there is for the benefit of the insurance-buying public. At the very front of the insurance code, the legislature has instructed us to, quote, liberally construe the insurance code for the benefit of the insurance-buying public. And we take that mission very seriously. Our fundamental goal has been consumer protection, going back into the 19th century. I should also note that the two parts of our mission are mutually reinforcing, the consumer protection and the positive business climate, because in my 10 years with the Insurance Division, I've learned that there's nothing, absolutely nothing worse for insurers than not to have an insurance market available in a particular area where they really need an insurance product. So it's vital to us to have a strong, competitive insurance market out there in each of the major lines of insurance in order then to focus on some of our consumer protection goals. How do we carry out this mission? We have three fundamental purposes that flow from the mission. First is the financial soundness of insurers. Second is the fair treatment of consumers in the insurance marketplace. And third is ensuring doing what we can to promote the affordability and availability of insurance, particularly in lines that are troubled lines of insurance. Let me start with the financial soundness of insurers. This is our top consumer protection priority. If you think about the nature of the insurance product, it's really just a promise. There's a piece of paper there called an insurance contract or an insurance policy. All it does is promises to pay somebody later, sometimes many years later, in exchange for an upfront premium today. So it becomes very important to make sure that insurers have the wherewithal, the resources to honor those long-term promises. Again, there is no worse outcome for a consumer than to have paid premiums for a number of years, and when it comes time to actually use the policy, most consumers don't want to use their insurance policies, but when they have to use them, to find out that the money's not there to honor the promises that were made in the contract. I'm happy to report to you that we have not had an insolvency of a domestic insurer here in Oregon since 1991. That doesn't mean that we haven't had some close calls. Every year on an ongoing basis, we're dealing usually with a very small number of insurers, but at any given time, I've got two or three that are on my radar screen, and my staff's got more on their radar screen that are experiencing some level of financial difficulty. Really, what we try to do is an early detection of problems. We look at annual statements, quarterly statements, and try to identify problems as early as possible and then work with insurers to make sure that those problems are solved. In a couple cases in the last few years, we've even had to work with companies to kind of phase into a merger with another company or that sort of thing to try to deal with problems. It's in the nature of these things that they're confidential. If the public were to find out about a company that's in a little bit of trouble, that would likely make it become a more of a crisis situation. So a lot of the work that my financial guys do is done very quietly behind the scenes, but it is important work, and it contributes to the fact that we haven't had any insolvencies since 1991. Should also note here that our financial program is part of a national accreditation program. Insurance is by far the largest industry in the United States. It is regulated primarily or exclusively, really, at the state level. The compromise that's necessary then to make regulation work well, given that many of the companies are national and even international, is that we have a very strong national association, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and we meet often and work closely together to have our regulations work in a coordinated way with these large national companies. On the financial side, that means that basically each state is responsible for its domestic companies. So we have 51 domestics that we keep a very close eye on, and then we have a total of 1,600 companies in the state that are licensed, but we depend on their domestic regulators primarily to watch their own domestics, and so that system of accreditation allows for both efficiencies and effectiveness in the way the regulatory programs are carried out. Oregon was first accredited in 1994 and has been reaccredited twice since. I understand a question came up yesterday, too, about kind of professional education and designations that are part of our regulatory staff. In my insurance division, I have 93 employees total. I have 41 designations. Some people have a couple. I think one person has three. But there are a number of our, particularly in the financial area and in the market regulation area, our key people are part of accreditation programs, professional designations, and take ongoing continuing education and that sort of thing as well. Moving to the second purpose, fair treatment of consumers. It's one thing for a company to have the money to pay, but consumer security about insurance also depends on fair treatment of the consumer in the marketplace. Anybody who's looked at their own insurance contracts likely has a head-scratching to do, because it's not really easy to figure out exactly what those contracts mean in any given context, and so it becomes important for us as regulators to ensure that those contracts are fair to the consumer and that they're interpreted in fair ways. Some of our market regulatory activity is long-standing activity. The Unfair Claims Practices Act, the Unfair Claims Settlement Act. These are laws that have been in place for decades. But some of it's newer in form. Patient protection was an issue in the health insurance market in the late 1990s. This legislature passed major reforms in 1997 and 2001. Last session, consumers were particularly bothered by some of the credit scoring practices of the property and casualty insurers, and this legislature took aggressive action on that problem. So we have kind of a mix of long-standing, fairly traditional pay the claims on time type regulation, and also some newer regulation to address problems as they occur in the marketplace. Just this past year, we adopted for the first time in Oregon a suitability standard for life insurance to ensure that, particularly with elderly people, the products that are sold to them in the life insurance arena are suitable to their needs. So it's an ongoing process of trying to be proactive and identify the most important consumer problems and then address them through our programs on fair treatment of consumers. Finally, an area that's been particularly active in the last couple of years, affordability and availability of insurance, particularly because the property and casualty sectors have been in what we in insurance call a hard market. Insurance is a cyclical business, particularly on the property and casualty side, much as the economy, capitalist economy, is cyclical. The trends don't always match up exactly, but it does have that same peaks and valleys type aspect to it. And particularly 2001, 2002, 2003, we were in a pretty serious hard market. They happen every 10 to 15 years, typically. And so there were a lot of affordability and availability problems at that time. There were...
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, I have a question on that, because when you think of insurance and affordability, normally you would consider the primary relationship would between would be premiums and claims utilization. And so if there was a major effect in affordability, it would either be because during those years there were extraordinary amounts of claims, or there were other factors that affected the affordability. And so to what extent is the stock market's ebbs and flows directly affecting the cost of consumers in their premiums, regardless of their claims history?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, very good question. It has an effect. I think it can easily be overstated, but it also shouldn't be understated that insurers do accumulate large reserves of capital, both reserving against claims and surplus, and so they do have an active presence in the stock market and in the bond market and other investments. And when investments are good, they do better, and when investments aren't so good, they don't do so well either. So that is a factor in these markets, but as you'll see when I talk about three specific examples, it also has a lot to do with the particular claims histories and the kinds of losses that are occurring in particular markets. So when there are hard markets in property and casualty generally, it doesn't hit all the markets equally. It hits some worse than others. The three that we've been particularly watching for the last several years now are medical malpractice. I actually came from a medical malpractice meeting upstairs where the doctors and the lawyers are actually sitting down and talking to each other in kind of an amazing way right now. That market is the issue of particularly with OBs and with neurosurgeons, cases that result in large losses are a driving force in that market. So there's a loss basis to that marketplace and some of the problems it's experienced. Contractor liability is the second one that we've had an eye on. I mean, if you think about the way houses were built 50 years ago and then the way houses are built today, you start to get maybe an inkling that why there are more losses and more claims in that market, and that's turned into some problems in the contractor liability market. And then third, adult foster care is a difficult market here in Oregon right now. And some of that is that we're victims of our own success. We've been more successful than most states in closing down some of our large institutions and having people out in the community in adult foster care. While insurers, being the risk-averse people they are, look at some of the kind of people who are now out in the adult foster care market and think, well, this is higher risk than maybe it is in other states. And so we have a problem in that market. So investments are part of it, but so are particular characteristics of particular markets, and the loss behavior that you cite is a key variable in all of these situations. That then is some of the property and casualty issues we deal with on affordability and availability. We also deal with health insurance on a regular basis. We're all familiar with the double-digit rate increases that we continue to see, not just here in Oregon, but across the country in health insurance. So we have a number of programs to try to address issues there. In the basic homeowner, auto, and health markets, we have a residual market strategy where if you can't get insurance in the general private market, there are options for you. You're going to hear this afternoon from Rocky King, who administers the state's high-risk pool for health insurance, absolutely critical part of the overall structure there. But we lift up this affordability and availability of insurance as our third purpose, because it could be folded under fair treatment, but it's really important enough to be highlighted separately. Those then are the three major purposes we have. In terms of programs to carry them out, if you look at page one of our materials, you'll see we have three basic program areas. Financial regulation achieves those financial purposes I've talked about already. We added 76 new insurers in the last biennium and now have 1,657 total insurers in Oregon. Again, no insolvency since 1991. To carry out our fair treatment of consumers and our affordability and availability of insurance, we have two other program areas, which are market regulation, which market regulation essentially focuses on insurer compliance with laws that are on the books already here in Oregon. And then we have a consumer services section. That section handles 20,000 inquiries and 5,000 consumer complaints every year and is an excellent source for us of material, kind of raw material on what is going on in our marketplace. And we increasingly use what we see there. We look at complaint trends, and then our market regulatory programs are designed to address the kinds of problems that are coming up through consumer complaints. Not everything comes through consumer complaints, but that's the principal focus we have in terms of trying to identify new hotspots for consumers and addressing those areas. There's much more material on those three areas in the accomplishments page in our material, page three of the material, and then page four goes through our kind of key priorities in each of those areas, but that's probably better material for phase two. So that I'll conclude, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then the last one of our major divisions is building codes, and we'd like to ask Mark Long to come up.
Come on up. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good seeing you.
Seeing you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mark Long with State Building Codes Division. And I also will try to be respectful of your time crunch and probably just give you an overview of what we do, what we're up to these days, and a little bit about building codes. First and foremost, State Building Codes Division was created in 1973. It is a unique system in Oregon. I think it's something that the legislature and this committee should know. We're one of only five models in the entire country that have what's called a statewide code. And what that means is the code or the standards that we adopt at the state level are applicable everywhere in Oregon. So it is what we call a mini-maxi standard. It's quite unique in regulation where if we set a standard, even if it's carried out at local government, that is the standard. We don't go below that. We don't go above that standard. And again, that's quite unique. What we do several different things to help promote consistency in the economy and regulate safe structures in Oregon. And the first thing is we adopt statewide codes, as I mentioned. And you can say, well, what are those codes? Well, those are things like building codes, electrical codes, boiler codes, elevator codes, recreational vehicle codes. Essentially, if it's built in Oregon, we adopt a standard for it, and it's carried out either through our services or through local government. We provide education, we provide consultation, we provide interpretation to contractors, inspectors, developers, manufacturers on the code. We also administer trades licenses. I oversee 85 different license types: electrician's license, plumber's license, boilermaker's license, etc. And I regulate 42,000 people with these different 85 different licenses that we have. We carry out enforcement, so we oversee the activities of these licensees. We set standards for local government and oversee their activities. And then we also conduct inspections. I think it's important to note that we really have two different kind of inspection services. We provide inspections in areas where cities and counties choose not to provide those services. That's primarily in rural parts of the state. We have offices over in Umatilla County, Coos County, and Wasco County. We also provide what we call statewide inspections for all the boilers most of the boilers in the state, all the elevators in the state, manufactured housing, recreational vehicles, those kinds of things. I'd like to share just some quick, fast facts about construction in Oregon that I thought might be interesting to the group. In Oregon, construction contributes $5.5 billion to Oregon's economy. So sometimes when you wonder, why are there so many building codes bills, and sometimes why is there so much interest in building codes, we're a relatively small organization. I think that when you're 5% of the total gross economy of the state, that probably tells you why. Just to give you a little reference, agriculture-related products is 3%, manufacturing is 15% of the total gross economy of the state. So 5%, $5.5 billion. On a national level, there are 40,000 building departments carrying out inspections in this country. On a local level, we have 130. We oversee those 130 different jurisdictions. And we work with seven different boards to help us carry out adoption of codes, issue licenses, provide interpretations, training, enforcement, and those kinds of things.
Let me ask you a question there.
You bet.
On those boards, how is the membership to those different boards selected?
Mr. Chair, it's different per board, but essentially the positions are created in statute, and then the governor recommends nominations and the Senate confirms for most of the boards.
They're statutory then?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And they vary from 15 members to 7 or 8. It just depends on the different boards. This last year, we added two new boards to the system, and we're in the process of getting those up and running. Just quickly for building codes, some of my priorities for not only the division that I oversee, but frankly for the state of Oregon and working on construction is consistency, customer service, and what I call compliance. It's easy for me to remember that, but really accountability, streamlining regulations, and then making sure that the efforts that we're doing at the state, as well in the local areas, are designed to help support Oregon's economic development. And I think that's an important piece. Over the last couple of years, since I was last in front of this group, what I've heard from the legislature and from the customers that I serve, that frankly results matter, and that we need to focus on results, and we need to think about our state services in a different light than we have before. And I'll share just a quick comment that one of the legislators shared with me. He said, Mark, your organization has been a pocket watch organization that regulates pocket watches. He says, we don't have pocket watches anymore in this state, and what are you doing to change how we regulate construction and provide services in this state? And I think we're doing quite a few different things, and I'd like to talk about those. We're streamlining regulations. We worked last session on a variety of bills. One of the ones I'm most proud of is deals with manufacturing equipment. We essentially took the position, the prior position of the regulation was that all manufacturing equipment was deemed to be unsafe, whether it was a high-tech piece of equipment or a toaster or something like that. And we said, no, we actually have data on what's safe and what isn't, so let's say that it is safe, and we'll only regulate the components that we're having a problem with. That really streamlined the regulations, and it really flipped 180 how we look at regulating equipment in this state. We've consolidated license types. We're now allowing some of our contractors to blend licenses together so that they don't have to carry three different licenses in their pocket, and they can renew on one date. I think that's important, and we've accomplished that over the last interim. And we've reduced the number of code amendments in this state by roughly 30% in the building code alone. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but if I recall, it's around 1,200 code amendments, local Oregon-specific amendments to a national code, and we've reduced that number significantly, and I'm pretty proud of those efforts. As far as consistency, customer service, and compliance, one of the things that we're working on that I'll have in effect here real soon deals with local government inspectors, and this is extremely important to me. It's a small thing, but I think it makes sense, and that is if any inspector in this state, and we're shooting for July 1st, writes up a citation, requires a correction of a contractor, they actually have to now or will provide the citation or the basis for that correction. To date, that's not a requirement. And I think it's extremely important if we're going to, as a regulatory body, have somebody either change their construction or come back and perform a re-inspection or a rework, that we need to provide the code reference for that. I know that sounds like a small thing, but that's actually quite important for consistency and accountability and customer service, making sure folks know what it is that we're doing. We're also adopting standards to increase inspector accountability and raising the threshold for building officials in local jurisdictions to carry out inspection activities. In the areas of customer service, we're embarking on something that's probably I'm most proud of, and that is an e-pay system in the Tri-County area. In mid-April, customers in six jurisdictions in the Tri-County area will be able to access a website that we've created and apply for permits, pay for those permits, schedule their inspections for those permits and get authorization to begin work for those permits online, over-the-counter, electronically. And I think that's extremely important to promote customer service and consistency. We're piloting with jurisdictions such as Portland, Clackamas County, Washington County, Hillsborough, Beaverton, Milwaukee. Another thing that we've worked on this interim is something called our rapid assessment team. And essentially what happened is, with last session, Senate Bill 715 gave us the authority to really analyze essential construction projects in the state, regardless of where they are located, and determine if there's adequate resources to get that project up and running quickly. And I'm proud to share with you, I haven't had one single application where we went out and provided rapid assistance services, essentially where the state either took over the project or delegated it out to someone else. However, I've had several different businesses interested in the service, and when I show up in the local community, talk about the services that are available, work with the local jurisdictions, we've been able to make commitments through the local jurisdictions that the project will proceed timely, quickly, and meet the customer's needs. And I think having that relief valve for customers in the state of Oregon on essential projects is very important and has helped change thinking about construction in Oregon. We've also conducted customer surveys in the interim on our licensees that we serve and found quite a bit of interest in streamlining our processes, and so we'll be working on that. One of the last things I'll share with you, and then I'll take some questions, is we've been asked to think about, as in government, think about state services differently. And there's a couple areas where we've done that. We've worked with industry and local government to create a public advertising campaign and a public website to alert consumers about when they need a permit, why it's important to hire a licensed contractor, some of the questions that they should know. It's called Permits Protect. We've actually, what we do is we have everybody pitch together from $500 to $1,000 of their money, and we help leverage those resources, and then we buy ad spots, and we help develop websites, and we send out brochures, and we're embarking on a new campaign called Joe Saturday, where it talks about the importance of homeowner work, repair work, alteration work, and using licensed contractors and getting permits and inspection. Hopefully some of you have heard that, and it will be broadcast here in the near future. And I'm very proud of that kind of grassroots kind of effort where people get together and really help communicate to consumers. The other thing that we've done is our industries have come to me and said, you know, enforcement is extremely important. If we're going to spend the time and the resources to be licensed in this state, we need to make sure that those licenses and workers are adequately trained and that there's an enforcement presence. So we partnered up with, frankly, our union and our non-union workers in the electrical program, our contractors, our local governments in the division, to pool resources again and hire an individual that will provide enforcement services, frankly, weekends and after hours. For the state to be able to do that, you run into some complications, and so we've been able to work with industry and bring in somebody that can provide a presence in a pilot area in the mid Willamette Valley area, supporting enforcement efforts in, like I said, weekends and after hours. Those are the things that we're working on. There's a lot of change going on in our organization. We are trying to shift from that pocket watch mentality that some of may have had about building codes in the past and really focus on, again, making sure that there are, it's consistent application of the building code, that we're providing good customer service, not only at Building Codes Division, but in our local jurisdictions as well, and then making sure there's adequate oversight and accountability in the system so that folks can build in Oregon and we get safe structures on time, frankly, on budget, and we're providing good regulation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. I understand Senator Carter may have had a question from yesterday, and she's not here to respond to that, so we'll probably hold that over, and I can talk to her. But
any questions? Representative Richards.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Long, you may have been aware that I talked with Corey about his concern that with the, you know, the zealous attempt to be efficient and through consolidation, that it might also have unintended consequences on small groups of of business people in Oregon, such as IT men who have or women who have worked putting together systems, a standard kind of network system that could run their own computer cables, but now can't unless they have a license. That to get that license, they have to be qualified to handle a whole number of items, which they never get into. And so I'm wondering if there has been any move, or is there a way that people could have a sub-license or something so that they can do those areas that are focused when they're only focused on one area and not on the broad area of a license.
You bet. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, first of all, I think we talked about this issue back in December at a different committee. Is this the same issue that we talked about? Just want to make sure I'm on the right page. Well, first and foremost, the committee should know that in the electrical area, we have an electrical board, and they are a policy-making board when it comes to the issue of licensure. And so after you pointed this issue out, we went back and talked to our board. We've talked to our industry. And I wish I could commit to you that I could change the statute or the rules that created that system, but I have found that there's interest from the contractors, at least, in looking at that issue and determining whether or not we should be taking someone that's doing computer cabling or HVAC work or instrumentation work or other types of work that is really non-life safety work, and requiring those folks to bundle together under one license and have experience in those various different categories, even though they want to do one particular piece. I think that's what we're talking about. I've talked to the contractors. They seem interested. It would take a combination of a rule change that our board would carry out for us, as well as, frankly, a possible legislative change. And so I can assure you that I'm talking about it. I wish I could tell you that I could fix that under my own authority. I can't. But I'm concerned about that and asking folks to take a look at it and see if we can make some changes. So, and then I'd also be happy to, I think when we talked back in December, Representative Richardson, that there may be an alternative way for a particular client to get through either equivalency experience or a different training standard through an apprenticeship. And I'd be happy to work with an individual and see if we can help solve the specific problem at the same time looking at the broader problem.
The reason I bring it up is it's not because of one person's specific problem.
Okay.
It's the situation where in our zeal to do our jobs, we end up causing more grief for the businessman or businesswoman, business person, I got to be PC on this, than intended. And we're not here to merely make sure that people keep the rules. We're here to help there be safety and consistency in the way business is done, but trying to enable people to make a living and to do their work. And so I just am constantly wanting to make sure that our various departments of government understand that, you know, we are public servants to help people, not merely make sure that help them comply with rules that we place that are burdensome to them. And in this one instance, you're saying, well, we could help him get tutored or do other things so that he could qualify for this broad license, but he doesn't want the broad license. He doesn't want to be qualified to do all these other things. He merely wants to be able to do what he's been doing for 20 years, and there's a lot of other people like him. And so it's the government that has said, well, from now on, you can't just do that. You have to be qualified for all of these things because that's the way we've changed the rules. So I know you can't change that. I'm just making a statement that we need to do what we can to provide flexibility for businessmen and women.
Chair Smith, Representative Richardson, I couldn't agree more. And the more we look into this, I think I agree with you, and I'd be happy to, again, turn up the heat on our board and our industry to take a look at these issues and make sure that we don't have unintended consequences when they're trying to consolidate licenses together. And frankly, I'm not sure that was the intent when that license was created, but that has been the outcome.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, on the larger point as well, it obviously extends beyond just the specific building codes issue. We as regulators overall need to be particularly cautious not to have a one-size-fits-all and a set of requirements that might be suitable for a large and sophisticated entity often aren't suitable for a small entity that doesn't pose the same level of risk and doesn't need the same level of scrutiny or need to meet the same standards. So that is something that we actually try to be conscious of in the broader regulation or regulatory issues we look at.
Thank you.
I bet you feel like you have a bullseye on you sometimes with the
most days, most evenings.
Yes. You do a good job. Question for you.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle entrepreneurs in remote parts of the state in helping them get the information they need?
Well, Mr. Chair, frankly, we need to do a better job. We are beginning to work closely with the Governor's Economic Revitalization Team, I believe it's called GERT, hopefully the committee's familiar with that, to develop those relationships, especially in rural areas, so that as individuals become familiar with or interested in businesses or construction, that from the very beginning we can be involved in helping them get through the maze of regulations. One of the problems that I see with building codes in our organization, this is kind of the changing the thinking, is we're actually come in last usually. You know, folks go and they think about it and they talk to the planning and they talk to economic development folks and they talk to financing and those kind of things. Then we start thinking about how does the regulation impact me? And we're trying to get in on the front side through the local, what used to be Community Solutions, but Governor's Economic Revitalization Team being part of that, having discussions so that in the very beginning we're talking with folks. And I can give you examples of even your district where we've sat down with folks that I think it's Noble Panels wanted to expand business, and we made commitments through that process that the plan review and inspection would occur within their time schedule that they needed. So all I can say is we're working on it. It's a top priority of me. We're updating our information on our web through our Permits Protect system. And then, like I said, getting involved in other institutions that are working with people before they think about the regulation is my approach to helping entrepreneurs and new businesses.
Well, one of the things I'm going to carry as a common theme for the next hopefully 5 months, but probably, what, 6-7 months, is our small businesses and making sure that we as a committee are doing everything we can to reach out to small businesses. And I would like to have further discussions with you on ideas I have.
That'd be great.
Because I think there are some tools available that are very accessible to your division that, with a little bit of linkage and a little bit of partnership, could assist you and could assist other partners and ultimately assist the entrepreneur who's looking at trying to undertake a project.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be great, and I'll be happy to talk. Those are the kind of thinking about government services differently.
Right.
I gave you a couple examples of what we're very interested in. You know, the governor and the boss has made it very clear that we're out there to look at regulations, assist businesses get through the system, and be a positive mechanism in the regulatory cog, as well as ensuring public safety. So that's you're headed exactly where I want to go.
If Alan comes up, he may need some help on this because we need to talk about it.
Great.
So, any other questions? Thank you very much.
You bet.
We now have 1 hour to get through. I've got Rocky, Raleigh, Pat, and Greg.
Mr. Chair, we should be fine.
All right.
We're getting through them today. Yes, we're moving back to insurance for a few minutes here with Rocky King, who's the head of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool.
Mr. Chair, I'll only take 45 minutes of that hour, and that'll leave us plenty of time. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, among other things, and I want to say that because there's some of you who also know me in my role as the administrator of the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and which has Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, the new certified plans. And through interagency agreement, we really, through DCBS, administer both of those. So for those of you who are wondering why I'm at the table on OMIP in one day and IPGB on the other, I hope you can understand that. I'm going to talk a little bit about what our mission is, who we serve, how we serve them, how the pool is financed, and some key accomplishments and challenges. But the best way to describe what the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is to say, if you are a worker in Coos Bay who works for a company who does not provide health insurance, and you have cancer or asthma or MS or diabetes or something else, your only option to get health insurance is to go to the individual market. Group market is not available to you through your employer. You will probably be turned down because of a pre-existing medical condition. The pool, established in 1989, serves the very purpose to provide a health benefit plan to all Oregonians that are denied coverage because of pre-existing health conditions. Another population or example of who we serve is someone who may be enrolled with Kaiser Health plans through their employer. They move to Bend, where there is no Kaiser, and they are not in a position to what we call port their coverage. That is, to take their group coverage to Bend because Kaiser doesn't serve Bend. We provide portability coverage or access to health benefit plans for those people who don't have portability coverage through their employer. Again, we were established in 1989 by the legislature to serve basically those two populations. We're one of 31 states, and we were the 12th in the nation to actually have a high-risk health insurance pool. Our mission is tied to the Oregon benchmark number 54, which is reducing the number of Oregonians without health insurance. Who we serve. Well, since inception, over the last 15 years, over 34,000 Oregonians have been enrolled in the pool, and current population is about 10,200. It's important to look at some of the demographics. The average age is 52 years old, 63% are female, and 60% have incomes under $35,000 a year. Eligibility is based on being an Oregon resident, not eligible for Medicaid or Medicare, and where you have been denied, again, eligibility for the individual market because of a pre-existing health condition. If you look at the commercial market, there's about 2 million people in the general commercial market that have coverage and took the top 10% of those in terms of their health care costs. That's kind of what this pool represents, only a much smaller number, about 10,000 again. Everything from spinal cord injuries, HIV, mental health, respiratory diseases, asthma. Very high-risk chronic health condition population. 20% of those 10,000 come to us from the portability market, that is, those who lose group coverage and have no other option. We're a division of DCBS, but we're managed by just kind of like an insurance company. We have a board of directors made up of 9 representatives, 5 of which come from the insurance industry. 2 are consumer advocates, 1 provider representative, and the director, Corey, is the department as the insurance commissioner, who also appoints the board. They help design the benefit plans, establish rates for the coverage. They determine the assessments of insurance carriers, which I'll talk about in a few minutes in terms of how we're funded. And they also select a third-party administrator that actually operates the program on a day-to-day basis, determines eligibility, pays claims.
I have a question. The graph on OMIP 5 says that 60% of OMIP population earn less than $35,000 annually. So that means 40% earn more than $35,000. Is there any relationship between the benefits provided and the wealth or assets of the recipient, the beneficiary?
Mr. Chair, who's that? Representative Richardson, no, there is no benefit difference between any of the 10,200 that are enrolled, other than the plan that they may enroll in. We provide 4 different options, from a $500 deductible plan up to a $1,500 deductible plan. And each one of those has a little bit different cost sharing. So whether you are someone who makes $20,000 a year or $50,000 a year, you select which of those 4 plans best meets your needs, and also in some cases your pocketbook.
May I follow up? Is it possible for someone who doesn't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan because of their assets and because they do have a severe illness or condition that wouldn't qualify them to get a private plan, that they then can have the benefits provided under OMIP and they're paid for by taxpayer dollars, even though they have independent assets and could exercise or use some of those assets for their own payment of treatment?
Representative Richardson, each applicant or each enrollee in OMIP pays a premium for being in the pool.
And is the premium is the same, or is it graduated based on their assets and income?
It's the same premium for everyone. It's up to 125% of the standard premium charged in the commercial market. So it isn't indexed to the particular income of that family. However, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which is separate side than in a different agency, but we administer, does provide premiums for low-income Oregonians, those that make less than 185% of the federal poverty level and meet other criteria established by the legislature and the board, does provide a subsidy from 50% to 95% of the premium. And those are generally 73% women, and I think their average age is like 54 years old, very lower income.
Okay, you know, I don't want to interfere with the train of thought you have, and you're focusing on those that really need it. My focus is on the other end, and I just want to get clarity that this plan is available to people so long as they have a health condition for which they can't get their own insurance. The taxpayers pay for the coverage, and it has nothing to do with the possibility that they have assets that they could use for their own costs.
Representative Richardson, we should clarify this is not a tax-supported program. There is no general fund tax support for this program at all.
Okay, who pays for it?
Let me talk about our funding source and how it's paid
and deal with, you know where I'm going.
Yeah, exactly.
I understand.
Just clarify that.
I understand. There are two sources of funding for this program. The first of all is premiums. Everyone who is enrolled in the program is charged a premium, and it can be up to 125% of the standard premium that's charged in the commercial market. So you enroll into the OMIP program, you would be charged a premium, say $300 a month. You have to pay that premium. You're responsible for that premium as well as co-pays or deductibles. So it was never established as a low-income program that subsidized people's premiums. There is a premium established. But it's important to note, for every dollar of premium we collect, we expend about $1.60 to $1.65 in claims. These are high chronic health condition folks. The balance of that 65 cents is collected through an assessment process of health insurers throughout the state. There are basically about 2 million people that our insurers cover, and we assess those based on the number of lives that each one of those covers. So there are no general fund dollars. It is strictly the premiums and then the assessments, which come in as other funds, from the insurers to cover those enrolled. Does that answer your question?
Well, it does as far as the source, and so it's not taxpayers, but it's other premium holders. Insurance companies are pooled as an assigned risk basis to provide this coverage, and those that are accessing it may have independent assets that they could use to pay for it, but it doesn't really matter in this instance because it's like an assigned risk insurance policy, and once they got the coverage, they get the benefits regardless of what their personal assets are.
Representative Richardson, as long as they continue to pay the premiums for that coverage, that would be correct.
Okay,
and they pay a monthly premium for that. Okay. Again, I wanted to just get where I left off, is that the board does offer 4 benefit plans on a statewide basis. They're modeled after the commercial and group and portability markets, with options for both deductibles and cost sharing. Premiums, again, are established by the board up to 125%. I should say that the number one reason that people end up leaving the pool is because of the high cost of those premiums, and the board tries to balance that by establishing the premiums a little less than what statutorily they're allowed, and premiums are currently at about 111% of the standard premium charged in the regular market. I have talked a little bit about some of the funding mechanisms, again, both the premium dollars and the assessments that are collected from the insurance companies. Key budget drivers, just like anything else in health insurance, the cost of health care, both in terms of its unit cost and its utilization. And by what I mean by that is that unit cost may be what it costs you from one year to the next to go to the doctor for the same thing. Utilization may be that you go to the doctor more than you went last year. As the population gets older and new technologies come out, we see both the unit cost and the utilization going up. And also, it's being caused by the enrollment increases that we project over the next 2 or 3 years. This pool started 15 years ago and has basically gone up every year except for a couple since that time. And that's being brought on by a decline in dependent coverage, for example, that's offered in the group market. In 2002, 49% of the firms that were offering coverage offered family and dependent coverage. According to the Office of Health Policy and Research, that figure has dropped down to 29%. So more and more employers are not providing group coverage for the dependents and of the employee. That's putting some and will continue to put pressure on enrollment. We have the expansion of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program to assist those low-income people who can't afford their share of the premium, and about 1,500 to 1,600 of the enrollment in OMIP receive some subsidy using state and federal funds to enroll into the OMIP program. And finally, as we've seen the decrease in the Medicaid standard population, it's dropped from almost 100,000 down to about 35,000. A number of those folks have, over the last year, started to migrate where they have the assets available or FEOP available into the high-risk pool. So it's a very steady climb that we've seen, and we anticipate that the pool will continue to rise given the high cost of health care and the erosion of the group market throughout the state of Oregon. On page 8 and 9, we have some key accomplishments and challenges, and also some key things that we would like to do. I think the big thing that we're challenged with, just like any health insurance company, is how do you control cost to make it more affordable for those people enrolled. We've put a lot of our effort in the last couple years and will continue around chronic disease management and also what we call intensive case management. And the purpose there is really to work with those people enrolled with some of those very high-cost chronic health conditions to see if we can make sure that they're getting into the right providers at the right time and that their care is getting managed appropriately in the right settings. We will continue to expand that. We're now doing Healthy Hearts. We do New Beginnings for those individuals who have children in our program. And we're also looking at diabetes, and we'll be moving in more into asthma as it becomes more of a cost factor for us. Customer service also is important to us. We do three customer satisfaction surveys, one when somebody comes into our program, one every 6 months, or after they've been in the program, excuse me, for 6 months, and then anytime someone leaves our program, we also do a survey to get some input from them in terms of how the program operated and what impact it had on their lives. We're going to continue to expand our website capabilities as well as improving member communications. That's kind of just kind of an overview of the program. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Perfect. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next we have Raleigh Lewis from our Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Businesses. I see your schedule says emergency small business.
Sometimes.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Raleigh Lewis, and I'm the manager for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. I would like to briefly talk with you about our mission, what we do, our goal, and the various things that we are doing to accomplish those goals. About our mission. Our mission is to ensure that minorities, women, and emerging small businesses have access to targeted contracting opportunities in both the public sector and the private sector. Our office is the sole certifying authority in Oregon. We certify firms to participate in three business enterprise programs. The first is the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program. That program is federally mandated and allows our firms to bid on contracts targeted by entities receiving federal transportation and or federal aviation funds, such as the Oregon Department of Transportation, TriMet, and the Port of Portland. The next program is the Minority and Women Business Enterprise Program. This program allows our firms to bid on contracts targeted by state, city, county, and other local jurisdiction with minority and women business enterprise participation policies, such as the City of Portland, Multnomah County, Metro, Portland Community College, Portland Development Commission, and Portland Housing Authority.
What about the City of Enterprise?
Pardon?
What about the City of Enterprise?
If they have a minority women participation policy, yes. And the last program is the Emerging Small Business Program. This program is race and gender neutral and allows Oregon-based businesses to participate on contracts targeted by city, state, and other local jurisdictions with emerging small business participation policy.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I want to go a little tiny bit deeper and just help me understand.
Okay.
Because often I get asked by constituents about doing business with the state of Oregon and how is there an Oregon preference? And when you say emerging small businesses, I think I understand what small business is, but tell me what would describe emerging.
An emerging small business is a business based in Oregon that has annual average receipts for construction of $1 million or less, and non-construction, $300,000. And it has employees of 20 employees or less. That is an emerging small business as defined by Oregon statute.
And you keep, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
You keep the emerging until you change. I mean, you could stay emerging and be a 10-year-old business.
And not participate in the program, however. There's a 7-year maximum participation. Now, there's a bill under consideration to change that to make it a 2-tier system, 6 years at one level and 6 years at another level, with a maximum of 12 years. But right now, the longest that an emerging small business can participate in the ESB program is 7 years.
One more follow-up.
Please follow up.
And I may be slipping back and forth between different agencies, and I'm going to need your patience to help me. I recently had a contact from a constituent who offered himself or in his services for an estate agency. He's an Oregon business, small, emerging by the definitions that you've just described. The contract ended up going to a huge firm in the Midwest, and it was a multi-year contract. The constituent who raised the issue with me wanted to complain to DAS, and basically just door after door after door shut. I didn't know where to send him for help. Would this be a DAS issue? Would it be an issue that you would I shouldn't use DAS, Department of Administrative Services. I apologize, Mr. Chair. Where does a person or a small business who thinks that they have met the criteria register a complaint or concern or ask for help as far as sorting out what state programs they qualify for, and how is it that an Oregon company that seems to meet some of the definitions can't get some kind of consideration?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, it may be a DAS issue, but one place the person can go is to the Governor's Advocate for Minority and Emerging Small Businesses. And I'm sure that she will assist that person, either providing the information that he needs directly or be responsible for collecting that information and getting back to him.
Good. Thank you.
And her job is to advocate for small businesses throughout the state. And I assume that that contract was a state contract.
It was a state contract for work to be performed in this state. And actually, and interestingly, the argument was made that my constituent shouldn't qualify because the company was too small, even though they were prepared to post bond, even though they were prepared to meet all the hurdles, and it ends up going to a big national firm back in the Midwest. It raises a question with me if we're doing more than just lip service to trying to acknowledge putting Oregonians to work by trying to hire Oregon firms that are capable of doing the business.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, again, I My recommendation would be to make contact with the governor's advocate for small business, small minority women and emerging small business. However, I am available also to assist that individual. So
good.
If that person will give me a call, I can help him navigate through the system and find someone that he can talk to and hopefully will get a satisfactory answer.
Thank you.
Our goal is to ensure that a pool of able, ready, and willing small business firms that are independently owned and controlled in both substance and form by minorities and women, and that emerging small businesses are available for targeted contract opportunities. And that has been a problem in the past. Our office is designed to ensure that that problem does not exist in the future. If contract opportunities exist for minority and women-owned businesses, our job is to ensure that a pool of qualified firms exists to take advantage of those opportunities.
Can you explain to us how you do that?
It's through our certification process, as well as through a few of the things that I will talk about briefly, what we're doing to make sure that businesses are aware that there are contract opportunities available, what the requirements are to take advantage of those contract opportunities. It is necessary that they get certified with us. What are the qualifications, the requirements to get certified? How long does it take for a firm to get certified, since that was a issue of concern
and
some time ago?
Who takes a business owner through that process?
Pardon?
Who takes a business owner through that process?
We do. What we have done...
Do you have staff members who are bilingual?
Not at the moment. We lost our bilingual staff person, but we have access to individuals who are bilingual. So if we need a person,
I have a group of entrepreneurs in North Morrow County, which is 60% Hispanic, and they want to participate in this, who do they talk to find out?
They can give our office a call, and we can
give... How do they do that if their English-speaking ability is limited?
Mr. Chair, maybe I can respond to that. We do have a multicultural program within the department that serves all of our different divisions. That's actually, in the director's office, is one of our shared services. So we have people in our department who, even though they might not be in a particular program area, can take calls in multiple languages and work with the program area specialists. We actually also offer salary differential to help in recruiting, and we have a lot of bilingual staff throughout the department. So if there is a particular need...
You're about to get the brunt of the chair, and the chair's allowed this prerogative every once in a while. I pride myself on the work I do in creating jobs throughout the state of Oregon. And over 5-6 years, I've represented 13 Eastern Oregon counties in the legislature through redistricting. I don't know one single thing you've done in my 13 counties. And I'll tell you what, I don't see the need for this. And I understand their special mandates. I understand their statutory obligations. But I don't see the work. And it's nothing personal to you. But I'll tell you what, something's going to change here, because I'll tell you what, this is one of the most important offices in the state of Oregon to make sure that every Oregonian has an opportunity to take advantage of the services available from the state of Oregon, and we're not reaching out to them. And before we as a state go out and talk about how we're going to develop high tech and we're going to develop this and we're going to develop that, we're going to take care of mom-and-pop businesses, and we're going to make sure that they have an opportunity to participate in the American dream. And I see you as a tool to do that, and I haven't seen it done.
Mr. Chair, that's our goal as well as the department. And if we're not doing an adequate job of outreach, we do want to hear about that, and point noted.
How about a report on the successes and not merely the good intention? I'm sorry. I'm just going to follow up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, we will be happy to provide that. We do a lot of outreach around the state And we can talk about what some of that outreach is and some of the work that we do with small businesses around the state. We actually did provide some material in the written information we provided today in response to the chair's question yesterday about our work with small business development centers. We limited that response to the work with small business development centers because that was the question that was added, that was asked. I think you will see that that does show a fair amount of activity around the state, not just here, not just in the valley, not just with high tech companies, but outreach around the state to small businesses, and we will be happy to follow up with you not only on our intentions but on our accomplishments.
Okay. Senator Berger.
Yes, I share some of the chair's frustration. I am a district, long coastal district, of nothing but small business. I mean, there are very few that you wouldn't consider small businesses, and most of them are ma and pa stores. So I share that, and it has been a tough ride for us in rural Oregon, and it's been tough to get attention. And it isn't because there are not a lot of us that have tried. Over years, before becoming a senator, I had 14 years, and I can go back 14 years of trying to get more attention from the state to the economic development of small business. I'm a little confused about the funding source. It comes from the state agency assessment fee. It says it's derived from all other state agencies that benefit from the growth of small business in Oregon. And I have to tell you that what we've seen has been the growth of big business in Oregon that turned out to be cyclical, just like the businesses that they closed down for us in rural Oregon, which was timber and fishing. And so the technology that flourished so in the 90s was just as cyclical. And so just think if some of that effort had been done in the smaller areas with small business, we would have had a little bit of some backset in support during the capital gains recession that we just went through. And then explain to me funding from the Oregon Department of Transportation. In fact, I'd like all the funding explained because I'm confused by it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, the funding that we receive is, as you mentioned, the assessment. And that assessment is designed to assist state agencies that are seeking to contract with minority, women, and emerging small businesses, primarily emerging small businesses, for state contracts. The funds that we receive from the Department of Transportation is in support of the federally mandated program. We do the certifications for the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program, which is managed by the Oregon Department of Transportation and mandated because of the receipt of federal funds. That the Oregon Department of Transportation is required to have a disadvantaged business program. Matter of fact, all entities receiving federal highway and federal aviation funds, ODOT being the primary entity in our state, receive dollars from the Department of Transportation, and as a condition of receiving those funds, ODOT is required to have a disadvantaged business program, and we do the certification for that program.
I see.
Mr. Chair, if I could add in response to Senator Berger's question as well as yours, the comment that you've made, Mr. Chair, and the comment that you've made, Senator Berger, is one that we hear on a regular basis. Who looks out for small business in Oregon? And I think all of us know that small business is the Oregon economy in many ways. And state government, generally, I couldn't tell you that there's this person's job is to look out for the interests of small business. Maybe there should be that person, and that's actually something we've been thinking a lot about because we are focused in some very specific program areas. We have a small business ombudsman whose job is workers' compensation, but it's focused on workers' compensation. We participate with many other agencies in setting up small business fairs where we as a group, cooperating agencies in Southern Oregon and other parts of the state have put on fairs where multiple agencies will provide information and services. But that's on an ad hoc basis. the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business is focused on really operating under some very specific state and federal statutes on certifying businesses that choose to be certified under those statutes. Many small businesses either for various reasons don't qualify or choose not to go through the certification process. The certification process is aimed at specific governmental contracting opportunities. But again, we have many resources that are aimed, and I should say the Office of Regulatory Streamlining as well. One of the focus areas is how regulatory burdens affect small business and what can we do about that. But each of those is a scattered effort. Each of those is an effort focusing on this issue, or this issue. I agree that as a state government, I don't think we have one person to talk to whose job it is to help small business succeed in the Oregon economy, and that may well be a lack. So I share the frustration. Again, Raleigh's program is a program that's limited in its scope. He does not have the statutory or programmatic jurisdiction to be the spokesperson for small business overall. But I share the frustration.
Let me ask a question, because where I'm from, you call it the way it is. I'll ask one question. If I'm wrong, then I'll back off.
Sure.
We have 19 small business development centers in the state. Have you been to all 19 of them?
I have not personally been to all 19 of them. I've been in the office since January of 2003. And I've been in this position since October of last year. Our office is focused primarily on certifying businesses to participate in those three programs.
Right. I understand that, but your small business development centers are the front line working with prospective entrepreneurs or emerging businesses, especially by your definition. And if you folks aren't walking through their front door and holding their hand, there's a link missing. So I'm done with my question.
Mr. Chair, I sense your concern, but I would point out in defense of this department, they have 5 FTE, and they're really focused, as the director has said, focused on compliance and certification. And I would suggest focused mostly on the construction contracting side. And so if we choose to expand his focus and resources, you know, that would be one way that we could address this problem. But, you know, 5 employees, pretty limited, and he is very focused in what he's doing.
Mr. Chair, but we are in regular contact with just about all of the SBDCs throughout the state.
Great.
We share information with them, and they make a lot of referrals to us when they provide business counseling to business owners if they believe that those owners can benefit from being certified and take advantage of contract opportunities.
Thank you. Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Sure. Next, we have Pat Allen from the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. We have been taking his name in vain in answer to some of these questions.
Pat, how you doing?
Fine, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pat Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. The office was created about 2 years ago by the governor's first executive order on regulatory streamlining. In that order, he directed that state agencies look at how they regulate business and find ways to make those regulations faster, cheaper, simpler, easier to comply with, while maintaining standards Oregonians expect for consumers, workers, public health, safety, the environment. He created the Office of Regulatory Streamlining in that same order as a vehicle to help organize that work. In the office, we act as a statewide clearinghouse for best practices, specific projects, organizing and driving multi-agency projects in various in connection with various initiatives in the business sector. We coordinate ongoing statewide customer service improvement efforts in relation to business regulation. One of the things the order effectively did was tell state agencies to look at businesses they regulate as among the many customers that they serve, assess how they're doing in terms of the effectiveness or the satisfaction of that customer service, and then work on projects to improve that, and we help with that effort. We also work with state and local government to improve regulatory systems and programs, figure out ways to deliver effective regulations in ways that have less impact on the economy. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Johnson.
Can I ask for a little more detail on work with, when you say we work with state and local government, we work with, I'm trying to just probe down a little bit further. Again, I have to go back and use as the barometer on how well things are working the number of constituent contacts that I get about the inability of state agencies to work together, the inability to have the DSL rules be the same one county to another, the DEQ rules be the same one county to another. Could you drill down a little further and tell us just exactly what kind of work you do in terms of working with state agencies?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, what I was actually going to get right to next was sort of what we've done over 2003-2005 in terms of the actual work and accomplishments. Just a couple of things to highlight at the highest level, and I think you've all at one time or another been briefed on the license directory that we've now got up and running and has been available for about a year and a half for for individuals. This is something that someone can go into today and be able to get access to concise, direct information about all licensed state licenses, permits, certifications. There are about 1,100 entries on that directory, and it provides things like what are the continuing education and testing requirements to get a license, what are the annual fees, how long is a license good for, what are the related rules and statutes. If there are downloadable license forms, there are links to those. If there is an ability to search the database of who has a license, there's that information. We think it's the most comprehensive system of its kind in the country, and we get lots of phone calls, lots of survey answers and things in response to that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
When you say if there's an ability to search the database for who are holders of those licenses, tell me what that means.
Sure. Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, that's driven by the system that the individual agency maintains. We pull information from their system. Most state licensing agencies have within their system the capability to search their database for licensees, but not all do, and we don't have the capability through the database to create something that doesn't exist. So we're pulling from the agency's system and compiling it all into one location.
Follow up.
I don't want to be difficult about this, but you're the streamlining guy.
Uh-huh.
And you're relying on other people that may or may not have the technology, may or may not have the cooperation, may or may not make it available to you. Explain to me where the teeth are. If you go to ODOT and you say, and I don't mean to pick on ODOT, somebody's listening on an ODOT camera somewhere, and I'm just not picking on ODOT, but you go to ODOT and you say, I want to have some piece of information from you about some piece of your business, and they say no, or we don't have it. Do you just say okay?
That? Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, not at all. Certainly the executive order directs agencies to cooperate with the office in terms of the work that we do, but the reality is that's not been necessary. The issue fundamentally isn't that we go and try to get something and the answer is no. The issue sometimes is we go and try to get something and there's not a capacity to deliver it. So let me take the example of being able to search your database of licensees. Big agencies like ODOT, that information is there and we're able to get that. Lots of small boards and commissions, on the other hand, I wouldn't even say lots, it's actually a minority of licenses where this is the case, but it's often smaller entities that don't have that search capability. What we are doing to help with that is the Department of Consumer and Business Services is working on a rollout. I know you've heard already in presentations about the license 2000 My License products that are a suite of products that help with license management and then the accessibility of those licenses for customers. We're working on helping other agencies learn from what we learn in that pilot and then exploring the possibility of being able to provide those services to other agencies, including those small boards and commissions that don't have that capacity. So we really are trying to help them where they're at and then provide additional assistance to get them to where they need to be.
So ideally, if I'm going to hang new cabinets in my kitchen and I want to find out that somebody who has a sign out on Highway 30 that says, I'm a cabinet guy, I want to find out if he's really licensed. Somewhere out there, there exists a database that you are the gatekeeper to, eventually, that I could type in this guy's name and find out if he's met all of the qualifications to do that kind of work in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the simple answer is yes. The only twist I would put on it is that rather than a gatekeeper, we're the consolidator of that information for everybody out there. The gatekeeper of that particular information would be the Construction Contractors Board, and they maintain that database. So there's really two different ways that person could get at the same information. If they happen to know Construction Contractors Board exists, they go right there and they get that information. If they don't, they could go to Oregon.gov/LIC, they find the search and they put in cabinets, and then the license for cabinet makers or contractors or whatever they search on comes back as part of what they find, and then that provides them a quick link to drill down and find that information.
Great. And you're coordinating, gathering all that kind of data up.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, Pat, it would be at some point really excellent if you could provide a presentation of that program.
Sure.
I've had an opportunity to see it. It's really neat. Senator Berger and then Senator Morse.
Yes. In your streamlining, I want to just kind of go to like building codes division.
Uh-huh.
I don't see some handouts here or in the folder that you suggested. Now, maybe you did, but I see that they want to streamline regulations and processes. Are these your recommendations that I see listed on page 4 of the BCD?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I think in those cases of those examples from building codes, those are suggestions that they have developed themselves dealing with their individual stakeholders. I would say that in the package of legislation that agencies have submitted and in the projects that we're working, there are a number of additional places where we are the source of the suggestions and are driving projects with agencies. I don't think they show up in that list you have from building codes right now.
Okay. Is there a place I can go that I can see what you have recommended in the streamlining for the building codes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ruger, I would have to develop that for you, but I'd be happy to do that.
Well, I don't want to put you to a lot of work on it. I just that's one of the things that people cry for all the time is the streamlining, and I would say that department particularly. So
If I could add, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, Mark Long from the Building Codes Division, who you just heard from, is a strong and vigorous advocate of streamlining himself and has been a source of many ideas. One of the things that the Office of Regulatory Streamlining does is share ideas among agencies, so that if a particular agency has developed a good idea, Pat looks for other agencies that maybe should be using the same idea and goes and sells it to them. And vice versa. So sharing best practices, Pat is not necessarily the one who thinks up everything. He is the one who also acts as a conduit of information back and forth.
Yes, well, you know, when the local jurisdictions gave you the job, or gave the department the job, a lot of it was because they simply didn't have the wherewithal to continue. And I just was curious about what kind of success you've had in streamlining with the technology that we have today, and why it isn't just working as well as it was when the local jurisdictions had it. Would you say that you think that that's the case, that it is working as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, in the building codes area specifically?
Yes.
As Mark discussed when he was up at the table, building codes, there are 130 different building codes jurisdictions. And what we have been doing is working with those local jurisdictions to try to get better streamlining, but in many respects, those local jurisdictions do make their own decisions. In the Tri-County area, as Mark described, for example, this spring, we will have that multi-jurisdictional online ability to get permits, schedule inspections, and pay fees. That's an example of the multi-jurisdictional streamlining work that's going on right now.
Okay.
Other efforts include streamlining the fee structure, streamlining the licensing structure. So there are actually a number of areas, and I think I can't speak for the industry, but I think if you were to ask, at least I hope the answer that you would get, Senator, is that actually people in the construction industry see significant steps being taken in building codes to make the system more efficient and usable.
Well, I have those in front of me. I just wanted to be sure that that wasn't something that Patrick had was referring to. I believe these came out of the department. Okay.
We're going to, Senator Morris, and then we have five more minutes, and we're going to move to Greg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you active at all in looking at the land use issues with respect to how that can be streamlined?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, there are a couple of ways to answer that question. At the simplest level, the governor's first two executive orders really dealt with regulatory streamlining and industrial lands, and so we've established effectively sort of a working division of labor between my office and between the economic revitalization team for me to focus on largely business regulations and for them to focus largely on those land use kinds of issues. Now, that said, the large area of all the regulations you have to deal with when you develop a project start with land use, but go way beyond that into building codes issues, as Senator Verger mentions, local sign ordinances, regulations dealing with operation, and so there is a place where we sort of pick up that issue. But in the main, my office has not worked directly on large-scale land use regulation as an issue.
Well, I would just follow up that in Lebanon, my hometown, we landed Lowe's, 700 jobs approximately. State was very active, local, city, county, great participation to bring that business to town. Now it stands at risk of the land use process thwarting that construction in Lebanon. So from my business experience, if there is one anchor to growing Oregon's economy, it's our land use system.
I appear to be the chair. Please continue.
Thank you. In the quick couple of minutes left, let me just hit on a couple of things briefly. The core of the work that the office has done in the last 2 years is material that's been previously reported to you consists of about 250 individual streamlining projects from over 40 state agencies that range from a few things that you'd characterize as really big deals, but lots really in the main of small incremental changes that improve systems. It's been one of the challenges of this initiative that, you know, there's no big sexy story to say, you know, gee, here's this big thing that we've made an impact on, but lots and lots and lots of small improvements that we think help make the state's regulatory systems better. Let me give you an example. Over the summer, we highlighted about 9 projects from state agencies where we focused just on paperwork. What were we doing to relieve businesses of paperwork or make that paperwork easier to do? Those 9 projects ranged from ODOT with Trucking Online, the ability of trucking companies to do all of their business from registrations to titling to weight mile tax reports and everything online, to projects at Oregon, at the Workers' Compensation Division that took exceptionally long forms and looked at really hard at the information we really needed to get and turned them into short forms. Yes, ma'am.
A couple of us the other day voted against a bill that seemed on its face probably a trivial little bill, but again, it reflects the fact that I think you're talking to some rural legislators here. Well, I applaud the initiative that you're undertaking to have lots of these filings online. What caution is being taken to assure that people without access to computers, people who are maybe restricted by either the cable doesn't go to the end of the road or they don't have enough money to have a computer, tell me what protections are being put in place so that we don't have two tiers of served citizens in this state, the ones with the technology who go to the front of the line and get the cheaper fees, and the ones without the technology who just get left behind?
Sure. Madam Chair, I know the bill you're referring to. I would say that in the case of ODOT and in the case of most of these kinds of projects, what's made available is an option to be able to do a transaction online and not a wholesale replacement of the paper-based accessibility. accessibility. And so that's the first backstop, is nobody that I'm aware of is out saying, from now on, this is the only way you can do that transaction. Of course, you know, separately, there are lots of investments being made and activity around expanding accessibility to online services and those kinds of things, either through libraries, small business development centers, or individually.
My good friend Senator Verger reminds me, the essence of it, though, is the fee. The fact that the bill that I was referring to had an incentive built in for the online filer and left the fellow or the woman without the computer to pay full retail. And that seems just inherently inequitable. And so I think some of us are looking for some reassurance that we haven't caused the less technology-capable financial distress and create two tiers of folks.
Madam Chair, if I could also just add in it, I mean, Pat has given you an example or two of items moving to optional online filing, and those are not examples where there's an additional fee. But a lot of what we're doing is just trying to eliminate having to do it at all.
And so
of these sample projects that Pat mentioned, yes, there were some that involved more electronic access. There were some that involved just getting rid of having to file a form or changing a five-page form into one page or et cetera. And some aimed at very small businesses, actually, because, you know, what we find is we've always done it that way. Oh, my God, yeah, of course I need that information. If you really are going to sit down and look at whether you really do need that information, there are things which you can just get rid of, and that's what we're trying to do whenever we can.
To give you a good example of that, from that list of those nine projects, the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, like a lot of licensing boards, previously required every time your license renewed, you had to submit a bunch of paperwork about your continuing education. Did you take it? What were the courses? Were they approved courses? And those kinds of things. What they have been able to do is to eliminate maintain the requirement that you do continuing education, but to eliminate the requirement that you send all the forms into the department. They audit a percentage of their licensees to, in fact, make sure that people took it and for people to know that there's that audit function going on. But it saves the licensee from having to submit a bunch of paperwork, saves the agency from having to deal with a lot of paperwork, and makes the system simpler while still maintaining the protection for people to know that their chiropractor is current in the training that he needs. It's the example of a kind of thing that Corey was talking about. If I can, let me...
Senator Verger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, could I follow up just a minute? I noticed on one of your presentations today, 20% of the people had actually filed electronically. I can't remember now which one of the presentations it was. But I was just looking at that. That really caught my eye, because I would love to find out what percentage of Oregonians actually have computers and use computers, because I think before we start saying that we're going to let them get a cheaper rate, we need to know how many people we're leaving behind.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I would also say there's probably a good distinction that can be drawn depending on whether the issue is a citizen's access or a business's access, and then in what type of business are they. For example, in one of our areas, which you heard about earlier today, is securities registration. Well, it may be one thing to say that securities registration has to be online, because, in fact, those businesses have access. But being conscious that it's not one size fits all, I think, is a critical point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, if I could also just add, the information you just specifically referred to, I do know that the Progress Board actually has that data, and I'd be happy to take responsibility for running down for you, you know, percentage of Oregon families with a computer and with online access. That data I know exists.
And we may even be able to get it geographically.
Yeah. If I could just hit one last project that I think illustrates the kind of work that we've been doing. We ended up getting a referral from Senator Nelson, I believe it was, of a business of his that runs a convenience store. You'd think of a convenience store, the typical convenience store that has a couple of gas pumps and sells beer and wine and cigarettes and food and, you know, the typical mix of products. You don't maybe ordinarily immediately think of that as an especially risky business. Come to find out that when you really peel it all back, there are 12 state agencies that license, regulate, inspect, audit, or somehow deal with that convenience store. Mm-hmm. Your first reaction is to say, well, you know, that's nuts. We've got to be able to get rid of some of that. Well, Department of Agriculture makes sure that the deli counter isn't going to give people E. coli, which will kill them. DEQ has a registration process for the underground storage tanks to make sure that 40 years from now we don't have to clean up a big mess again. OLCC licenses the sale of beer and wine and those kinds of things. None of the individual regulations themselves is something that you can just say, well, you know, gee, we ought to get rid of that. What we have started to look at, though, is we've looked at three or four of those agencies that actually go through an annual licensing function where they send some forms, the business person fills them out, writes a check, and sends them back. And an idea that we came up with in the office was to think, gee, is there a way we could actually maybe make that process simpler? So we're working with three of those agencies on a pilot project right now, OLCC, Agriculture, and DEQ, to do a combined license so that one time the business gets a set of paperwork. It's less paper overall than they would have dealt with because you don't have to ask the same questions over and over again. And one time they fill it out and one time they send a check back in. We're going to pilot that with 50 to 100 businesses. Hopefully this spring we're actually going to need a little bit of legislation to deal with some technical issues, and that's in the works. But it's the kind of thing where we're exploring how can we make those systems, keep the regulations because they're important regulations, but figure out how to make those systems work better for the businesses that have to comply.
We have a question here. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Pat, you know, if the person's in business, why would they have to get licensed every year? I mean, why not? If you made it every other year, you've just cut it down by 50%.
You're singing our song.
And the same thing with ODOT. I don't know if it got brought up as far as ODOT is concerned, but I'm going to be driving for years to come. Why not make longer times between having to relicense and then cut down the amount of paperwork that's involved?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that's exactly what the last thing I was going to talk about was the legislative package of bills we have in, and use that bill as an example. The license directory I talked about earlier, something that we can search and actually do some work with to figure out what's out there. One of the things we found is that there are over 350 individual licenses in the state that are one-year licenses. Let me ask the question, as you do, why is it a one-year license? Some of them, amusement park rides, thank heavens it's a one-year license, and somebody goes out and checks the amusement park annually to make sure it's not going to kill anybody. Some of them, like electrical contracting business, it's a business license, and looking at it, it doesn't look like there's a big public policy reason that couldn't be a 2 or 3 year license, except for the fact that almost all of those are statutory requirements that they be a 1 year license. Mm-hmm. So in order to try to maybe short circuit the notion of having 300 bills come in here extending each individual license to some different term, we have a bill in House Bill 2094, which authorizes state agencies to the extent that it's consistent with the reason that they have the license to offer extended license terms up to 5 years is how the bill is initially drafted. Now, the important language is offer extended license terms, because thinking about very, very small businesses, we're trying to be sensitive to the notion that if you take a one-year license with a $50 fee and turn it into a five-year license with a $250 fee, you've actually maybe created a cash flow problem for somebody where there wasn't one before.
Now, you're making an assumption that you would need to make it. Why not a $50 fee every 5 years and do a break for the citizen? If the $50 is at all related to the work that you're doing and you only do it once every 5 years, we're not talking about a revenue generator, we're talking about benefiting the business owner.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, the answer to that question is that in most licensing cases, the license fee pays not just for the transaction of issuing the license, but also for the enforcement program or the licensing program that goes behind it. And so even if you only do that transaction once over a longer period of time, the lion's share of the program still exists for that entire period of time and still needs to be funded for that period of time.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Could you kill two birds with one stone by allowing businesses that operate violation-free to get into a longer extension?
Yes.
Because even the amusement park, and I share your opinion that those probably you'd err more on the side of wanting to look at them, but if an amusement park operator operates incident-free for some period of time, they get a longer term on their next renewal.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, actually that exact issue has come up in this bill is before the House General Government Committee, and that issue exactly was, an issue was raised having to do with OLCC licenses and local government's ability to participate in the annual process of either issuing or renewing licenses, and that's exactly the tack that we're taking is some language that we're adding now to the original bill that deals with if someone if they got a clean record, we'll figure out how to word that, but tying the notion to that idea of somebody who's a good operator of whatever it is that they're supposed to operate, that's a finding that an agency needs to be able to make to offer an extended term. I think that's exactly the track that we're heading down.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe the relevant question here is how many licenses are revoked or not renewed because of violations? I mean, if you don't have any revocations or denials, then it is just
waste of time.
Yeah, I won't say it. But question, I don't know.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I'm not sure either. I really, that starts getting into the more the issue of looking at particular licenses and asking the question, why do we license what we license, or
well,
even more appropriately,
that's underlying.
Even more appropriately at this time of year, proposals that you may well see to add licensing and asking, you know, why are we going to add this regulation during the legislative concept development process? We worked with agencies to provide them some guidance to say, if you're going to propose new regulation, here's what you need to be able to say. You can boil that down into who are we trying to protect and what are we trying to protect them from, and is it real or is it hypothetical? Are we sure that government regulation is the only way to deliver that level of protection, and are we designing it in a way that makes sense, that gets the level of protection with the least impact? I think those would be the kind of questions that would be useful as you consider those kinds of proposals that may come up as well.
Well, colleagues, it's 3 p.m., and so that's the end of our day. Corey, can we ask Pat and Greg to come back tomorrow and to or
Monday?
Monday. It's a rookie here. We're getting this down. Come back on Monday and continue.
New collection. Certainly, Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to do that.
Thank you very much, and great job today. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Gee, that was the best discussion. That could produce the results.
I just want everybody doing up tomorrow. My and I'm including.
Because I'll bet people will just regret that.